Berukim Abayim, ladies, we are studying Parashat Vayera. Our Parashah opens up where Avraham Avinu is on the third day of his Brit Milah, the third day of his circumcision, which Hachamim tell us generally is the most painful day of the circumcision. Anything is painful when a 99-year-old man takes an operation. Certainly, in those days, they didn't have the benefits of anesthesia and all the other different things that would make life easier. Avraham Avinu was circumcised, and 3 days later, he's in his tent. It's an excruciating hot day, the Torah says. God, actually, it says, took the sun out of its shell, which means it was a very painfully hot day. And it says that he was sitting in the plains of Mamre. The Torah goes out of its way to tell us where he was located. It gives us an address, which at first glance really doesn't mean too much, because who cares where he was? The point is, he's in his tent. It doesn't matter if his tent is in Brooklyn, if it's in Deal, or if it's in Elone Mamre. So what does the Torah go out of its way to tell us his location, that he was in Elone Mamre? So there's a statement from Chazal, from our rabbis, that say that when God told Avraham to circumcise himself, Avraham went for some advice to some of his friends. It says Avraham had three people that he was close to. Their names were Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre. And it says in the Gemara that he went to ask them advice if he indeed should take the Brit Milah or not. And Aner told them, no, it's not good, you're too old, it's dangerous for you to do it. Eshkol told them, you have a lot of enemies, and if they're going to see you weak and vulnerable, they're going to attack, and it's going to endanger you. Mamre was the only one of his friends that told him, take the Brit Milah. There's nothing to talk about. You have to take the Brit Milah. Now, this Gemara is quite perplexing, because what do you mean? He needs advice? God told him to take a Brit Milah. Now he has to go ask his friends, what do they think? And Aner tells him, well, don't do it. What do you mean don't do it? God said to do it. Who's Aner to come tell Avraham Avinu, don't take the Brit Milah? And then Mamre is the only one that says take it. So I saw a beautiful explanation based on an idea that the late Rosh Yeshiva Panovich Rav Shach said. There's a certain principle about prophecy. Avraham is a prophet. There was only one prophet that received prophecy that's called Aspaklaria Meira. That means clear, lucid prophecy where you have no questions what the prophecy means. That was Moshe Rabbeinu. When God would communicate to Moshe, the reception was vivid. There was no second guessing what exactly God meant when he talked to Moshe. Moshe had clarity beyond any prophet. All other prophets besides Moshe, they saw prophecy, but the Gemara calls that Aspaklaria She'ena Me'ira. It wasn't vivid, it wasn't clear, which means you needed to interpret what God said. God said certain words, and you needed to take those words and try to explain what God means. So therefore, the job of a prophet was not just to receive prophecy, it was then to decipher the prophecy. God told me the following statement. What does he mean by these words? Now, again, Moshe Rabbeinu, the prophecy was clear, there was no question, there was no second guessing what God meant. That was the level of Moshe, he was so high, he was so close. But even Avraham Avinu, his prophecies needed interpretation. When God told Avraham to do the Brit Milah, Avraham Avinu had no question, of course, he has to do the Brit Milah. God says to do it, but the question is, what did God mean? Did God mean maybe for him to do it at this point in his life? Maybe he should delay it. Maybe he should do it in secrecy without anybody knowing. Why was Avraham concerned? Why does he have to hide the mitzvah? So the Midrash writes, because Avraham was concerned that this might dilute his ability to appeal to people. Avraham Avinu was an outspoken rabbi, a philosopher, a teacher, and therefore he was a public figure. His job was outreach. His job was to bring people closer to Hashem. And therefore, he had to be very careful in what he did, because he didn't want the perception of people towards him to think that he's a crazy man. I mean, what 99-year-old man goes and circumcises himself? And that's ridiculous in the normal world over here. He's got nothing better to do. And more so, the people might say, listen, if we become students of this man, he might tell us to do this the same. And if the rabbi is doing it, so one day he's going to tell us in class, you got to go circumcise yourself. The guy's Mishnu, the guy's crazy. So Avraham was concerned that this Brit Milah can actually stall or hinder his effect. His influence is going to become compromised if he does the Brit Milah in an outwardly fashion, if he does it in a public venue. So he went to Anir in his school and they told him, yeah, I agree with you. God, when he told you to do the Brit Milah, he couldn't have meant to do it in such a way. I mean, he must have meant, you know, do it in hiding, don't tell anybody. The only one that told them to do it, don't be embarrassed, do it in public, was Mamre. And the Midrash says what Mamre told him. Mamre told him, listen, Avraham, years ago, you had a fight or you had a debate with the king of the world at the time. His name was Nimrod. Nimrod claimed that there was no God. You claimed there was God. And Nimrod said that if Avraham does not concede to Nimrod, he's going to throw him into a fiery furnace. Of course, Avraham did not concede. Avraham believes in God. Nimrod took Avraham and threw him in a fiery furnace. Mamre says, you forgot when you jumped into the furnace? Then you didn't make any calculations. You didn't expect that you were going to walk out. You thought you were going to get burnt. What would have happened if you would have got burnt? You wouldn't be able to teach anybody. You wouldn't have any students. You wouldn't have any influence. You would have been gone. But the point is, you did what you had to do, because that's what God's word was at the time, and you can't make calculations. You can't start saying, well, if I do this mitzvah, that's going to happen, and this damage, and that problem, and that outcome. When God tells you to do something, that becomes the commandment, and nothing else is taken into consideration. What Mamre was really telling Abraham was, you can't play God. You can't start saying, well, if I do this, it's going to cause a damage. That's not your business. Your business is to follow the mitzvah. So it was Mamre that actually encouraged Avraham and said, worry not about the influence that this is going to have over your outreach program. Do the Brit Milah, do it in a public manner, don't hide it, and everything will be okay. So the Torah gives credit to Mamre, because he was the one that encouraged Avraham not to do the mitzvah, but the way he should do it, that he should do it and not be worried about any outcome. So that's why the Pasuk opens up, Vayirah Elav Hashem Be'elonim Mamre. In the plains of Mamre, it gives Mamre credible mention because he was the one that gave Avraham Avinu that advice in order to do it in such a manner. And now we understand something else, says the rabbi. On this day, Avraham went out of his way to entertain guests, even though he was in no condition to entertain guests. First of all, it's an excruciating hot day. They did not have central air conditioning in those days. And he just came out of an operation. And Avraham is pacing outside his tent looking for people that he can invite. And he sees three Palestinians walking down the street. It says three Arabs. And he's so elated, and he runs after them and he's grabbing them, please come sit. And the rabbi says, now we understand, because Avraham, according to Avraham, he was worried that now that he did the Brit Milah, maybe people are going to, you know, shy away from him. Maybe people are not going to want to get close to him. So he had to make an extra effort to bring people closer in order to show them that this is what God wanted. So if he went out of his way that day in order to come close to people, so they shouldn't, like I said, shy away. It's interesting to point out that Avraham Avinu serves the guests, that he coerced them, he forced them to come into the tent. He serves them tongue. It says he slaughtered three cows, and he gave each one his own tongue in front of him, which was a delicacy in those days. And Rashi goes out of his way to say he even gave them mustard. She says, Behardal. So that always bothered me. You know, that she has to go out of his way to tell me that he gave him mustard. You know, if he didn't give him mustard, why? It's not, it's not complete. So what I thought was, it's showing you the greatness of Avraham Avinu. I was thinking, if we would go visit the kitchens of some of the greatest rabbis of our time, If we would sneak up on them and open their Frigidaire, what would we see in the Frigidaire of the great rabbi of the generation? What does he keep in his Frigidaire exactly? I can only assume that you'd see bare necessities. You'd see a loaf of bread, you'd probably see some butter, you'd probably see some eggs, maybe some milk, maybe some juice even. But I doubt that the Gadol HaDor has condiments in his... So you're not going to see salsa in the Gadol HaDor's Frigidaire or A1 steak sauce or any of these other condiments. Certainly not. You're not going to see great Poupon mustard in the Gadol HaDor's. It's just something... Gadol is eating mustard. It's like it's a delicacy. Like it's an extra item. Why? Because I assume that the great Hachamim... They don't indulge in these extra items. Mustard is not one of the necessities of life. It's an extra. And usually the great rabbis, they live a life of deprivation. You know, they live the minimums. They're not looking for all the extra things. I'm not saying it's forbidden to eat mustard. I personally love mustard. I'm talking about the great, great, great luminaries of the generation. Now, Avraham Avinu is greater than any rabbi. Avraham Avinu probably never ate. You know, Baba Sali used to fast every single day of his life except Shabbat. So I'm assuming if Baba Sali fasted, rest assured Avraham Avinu was much more holy than the Baba Sali. So he wasn't sitting eating steak and mustard and all these things. So I said, what is Avraham Avinu doing with mustard in his house? So you see a lesson. Avraham kept the mustard in his house for his guests. And what do you learn from here? You learn from here a great lesson. That although Avraham Avinu was above mustard, although he was above all these delicacies and all these pleasures of life, but he did not impose his level of deprivation on his guests. When it came to his guests, he afforded them the greatest comfort. Instead of saying to them, no, here's bread and water, here's the bare minimum, this is the way we live in this house, just like I suffer, you have to suffer as well. That would not be right for Avraham Avinu to impose his level of spirituality on somebody else. Avraham Avinu understood that when it comes to religion, you have to worry about your own religion. When it comes to materialism, you worry about everybody else's materialism. Unfortunately, we do the opposite. We worry about our own materialism, and when it comes to religion, we worry about everybody else. You should do this, you should do that. How come you're not doing it? Leave me alone. It's not your business. Avraham Avinu kept his religion in his home. His level was his level. But when it came to guests, he wanted to pamper them and treat them. He didn't now punish his guests and demand from them to be on the same level that he was. That's what Avraham Avinu was doing with mustard in his house, in order to treat his guests in the proper way. They tell a story once of one of the great rabbis, Rav Zalman, who was the author of his book called The Tanya. He was one of the Hasidic rabbis. He was a Gaon, he was a great Hakam. So one time he walked into his son's home, and he saw his son was sitting learning in Torah. He was engrossed in the study of Gemara, and the baby was crying in the other room. And the rabbi was, he didn't even hear the baby, maybe. Maybe he was just so engrossed in his learning. The baby is crying and crying and crying. So Rav Zalman said, what are you doing? The baby's crying. So he said, but I'm learning. He says, more important to close the book. There's a baby crying, more important to worry about. That's the mitzvah of the time, which means to advance your own spiritual level at the expense of somebody else's physical pain is unacceptable. Therefore, you have to close the book and go learn. One time, the Gaon de Vilna was sitting in his sukkah. An elderly man walked in, and the Gaon de Vilna obviously didn't see him. The Gaon was engrossed in his learning as well. And the fellow waited and waited and waited, and the Gaon didn't have any recognition that he was even there, and the fellow left. Later, he came to the Gaon de Vilna and said, I'm quite offended. I came to the sukkah waiting for you. You didn't even see me. You didn't look at me. You didn't acknowledge. You didn't shake my hand. So the Gaon says, you'll forgive me. I had no... You're right. I'm wrong. Learning Torah is not supposed to make a person crude or cold to other people. I was lost in learning. I'm sorry. And he blessed the fellow. He says, I bless you that you should live to 100 years old. The fellow was nowhere near 100 at the time. And the story is told that when this fellow reached 98 years old, he became very ill. And his family told him that they have to rush him to the doctors. And he said, I don't need any doctors. The Gaon de Vilna promised me I'm going to live to 100 years old. And sure enough, he got better and he lived to 100 years old and he died on his 100th birthday. So you see over here the blessing of the Gaon, but you see also the Hakamim, how sensitive they were. If there was ever a lapse, if they ever denied somebody else's physical benefit, That bothered them. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter made a very important statement that we always have to keep in mind. He said, your friend's gashmiyut is your ruhaniyut, which means your friend's physical needs is your spiritual needs. Which means when you're doing a favor, when Abraham's giving his friend mustard, these guys mustard and steak, that's a mitzvah for Avraham Avinu. Pampering to somebody's physical needs is spiritual too. That's a mitzvah. And therefore, one has to look at it in that sense over here. Not to, like I said, deny others from things that even though you would deny yourself from. You're supposed to be more generous with others when it comes to the physical of their needs. Not even needs, of their luxuries. Trust me, these people could have done well with a glass of water and a bread and butter sandwich. Avraham Avinu went the extra effort, and not only to prepare it for them, but he actually waited on them, etc. There's an interesting thing I just saw on the way here. It says that he asked his son Yishmael to help him. The Pasuk writes that Ve'ela bakar ratz Avraham. Avraham ran to get the animals prepared. Vayikach ben bakar akmato vayiten el na'al. And he gave the food to the lad in order to have him also help in the mitzvah. So that she says this lad was Yishmael, and Avraham Avinu got his children involved in the mitzvah in order to train them in the mitzvah of Hachnasat Orchim. That's one way that we teach our children how to do mitzvot. When there's an opportunity, you have to get them involved. But I saw one point which is obvious, but I guess we take it for granted. Yishmael also took a circumcision on the same day Avraham did. So this was the third day of Yishmael's circumcision as well. So he was also in pain. It might not be the pain of a 99-year-old a man, but you know, a 13-year-old boy taking a Brit Milah is not so comfortable either. And it's the same excruciating heat and all that. So Avraham Avinu wasn't only training his children in Hachnasat Torahim and hospitality, but he was training them that under all circumstances. Which means with self-sacrifice. I'm sure Yishmael was lying in his bed, all bandaged up, resting. And now his father comes along and says, hurry up, hurry up. Get the food. What is that? Look at me over here. I'm sick. I can't move. But in Avraham Avinu's house, there was no such thing as doing mitzvot only when it's easy to do the mitzvot. In Avraham Avinu's house, mitzvot, that you had an opportunity to do a mitzvah, under all circumstances, even if it's uncomfortable, and he was able to preach that to Yishmael only because he himself did it. You see, if Avraham Avinu would have called his son Yishmael from his bed, Yishmael, get up and take care of the guests. Yishmael would have said to himself, hey, look at my father. Hey, for him, he doesn't want to inconvenience himself. And that's a very important lesson in general in parenting, that we have to be very careful that if we're going to tell our children a certain behavior that we want them to exemplify, be certain that we model that behavior ourselves. Avraham Avinu would not dare tell Yishmael, a sick man, after a three-day operation, an operation of 3 days, to go start running around feeding Arabs if he himself didn't do the same. That's what chinuch is. Chinuch is not only telling your children what to do, but chinuch is actually following the same advice that you give your children as well. The Torah goes on to tell us about the city of Sedom. Well, I'll make one more point. I'm seeing now in my notes there's one more point that is worthy to mention. In this hospitality, Sarah got involved. Of course, Sarah is the hostess. She was in a tent. Hachamim tell us Sarah was a very modest lady. She would rarely leave her tent to be outside in public. In the olden days, ladies not only dressed modestly, but they also lived modestly. In the sense that they didn't walk the streets even with long dresses and head coverings. They stayed at home. They didn't expose themselves to the outside. Very rarely did you find religious ladies in the workplace or in the marketplace. This was not becoming of a Jewish lady. Obviously, today the standard of modesty has dropped or has fallen a few notches. I'm being facetious when I say a few notches, because it's actually a few light years of notches. But the point is, that was the level of modesty, at least in the olden days. So now, Avraham tells Sarah, go and prepare cake or prepare bread, whatever it is. So the Pasuk writes that he tells Sarah, Mahari, hurry up. Shelo se'im kemach solet. Go prepare kemach solet. Now kemach is a type of flour and solet is a type of flour. Solet happens to be the fine flour. The important flour, the refined, sifted flour is called solet. That's the expensive stuff. The kemach is the regular generic flour. So what is Avraham telling his wife? Kemach solet. Make up your mind, Avraham. Should we use kemach or should we use solet? Or was he saying, use both? So the Gemara says over here that this was actually a little argument that Avraham and Sarah got into. Avraham was telling Sarah, use the solet. And Sarah came back and says, no, kemach. And they're arguing back and forth, kemach, no solet. No, kemach, no solet. So the Gemara says, why would Sarah want to use the inferior stuff on the guests? Use the solet, the guest is here. So the Gemara says a very, very strange statement that needs understanding. I think we explained it here once before, but it's worthy to say it again, to understand the words of Chachamim. Gemara says, you know why? From here you learn, Isha tzarat ayin be'orchin. From here we learn that a lady becomes stingy when it comes to guests. Oh, so that's what bothers us. So you see, Sarah's trying to chinch over here. She's trying to get away with giving the guests kemach. And so you see, she's trying to save over here. So this Gemara always perplexed me because in our community, at least in our families, we see the exact opposite. On the contrary, the guest gets the best, and the guest always has our tables have all the delicacies of King Solomon in his time. And therefore, we're not used to living like this, where we're miserly when it comes to hospitality. On the contrary, our community has set standards, the highest standards in hospitality. That there's no, we don't hold anything back. So what does it mean, Ishat Sarat Ayin Be'orfim? So I saw two explanations to understand this. One explanation I saw from Rabbi Shimon Schwab, Zichron Levracha. He says, when they say a lady is stingy when it comes to guests, it's not saying that the lady is cheap or miserly, that she's trying to save a penny. When Sarah was saying to Avraham, don't give them the solet. Why? Why does she want to give the solet to the guests? Shimon Schwab said, because she's saving the solet for Avraham. Because he said, a good Jewish wife has her husband's needs before anybody, even before the guests. So therefore, Sarai Menu, of course, she doesn't care about the money. What is it, solet? Kema, what does she care? But obviously, there was a certain amount of solet. And therefore, she already said, no, this is for you. I'm not giving this to the guests over here. You're my husband. To show you the loyalty that the lady has for the husband, that even above guests, she, in her mind, she wants to impress her husband, to give him even better what she serves the guests. That's one explanation. That's a lesson that we have to learn in general, which is also Baruch Hashem practice in our parts. I heard another explanation from Rabbi Pinchasi, may he live and be well. Rabbi Pinchasi explained this Gemara a little different. He said that the Gemara is telling us something different. It's not telling us that a lady necessarily wants to give guests less food or more food. That's not the point of the Gemara. A lady is a little stingy when it comes to guests because when the husband comes home, that's the private time that she's able to spend with her husband. And the lady yearns those few moments a day where she could review the day, talk to her husband, have a little private time with an interruption. And now all of a sudden the husband comes home from work and he has three guests with him. So now she knows she's not going to get one word into her husband because the husband has to entertain the guests and everybody's talking to the guests. There's no private time. So that's what the Gemara means. Ishat sarat ayin be'orchin. She's really stingy with her time that she has with her husband. And therefore she doesn't want to share it with guests. And therefore, she'd rather have the husband. So again, it shows another principle. It's not about money over here, and it's not about being cheap, chas v'shalom. It's about the loyalty that a Jewish lady has for her husband. She wants to give the husband the best of the food that's in the house, and she doesn't want the guest eating it, and she wants to spend all the time that she has, the limited time that there is in the day, she doesn't want to share it with anybody. This is noble. This is something to praise a Jewish lady. This is something that's a positive thing, that a Jewish lady puts her husband's needs before anybody else. That already is something that's commendable. That's something the Gemara is not saying, chas v'shalom, a weakness of a Jewish lady, but the Gemara is telling us the strength of a Jewish lady is that she puts her husband's needs before anything else because she has great value of the time that they spent together and of satisfying his needs, even the physical needs, like we said, of giving him the best foods, etc. We go to the story of Sedom. We read about the story of Sedom in this week's parasha. We read about how Lot, the nephew of Abraham, lived in Sedom, and how miraculously he was saved. The angels came to visit Sedom. They told him that the city is going to be destroyed. They flew him out on a magic carpet, however you want to say. They saved him. His wife, of course, turned around to see the destruction, and the tradition tells us she turned into a pillar of salt because she wasn't supposed to look. And the rabbis tell us that Lot was not the best of people. As a matter of fact, we can really question the personality of Lot. This was a man that was the nephew of Abraham, who was traveling with Abraham. When Abraham made his voyage, his pilgrimage to Israel for the first time, Lot was with him. And then Lot could not withstand the tests to live in the presence of Abraham Avinu. And then he tells Abraham that he wants to move. And where does he move to? He chooses to move to Sedom. Now that's a second ago you're living with the greatest man that ever lived. And then on a dime now, it's like, you know, a guy's living with Chacham of Adya Yosef, I don't know how many years, and then one day he tells the rabbi, listen, Rabbi, I can't take anymore, I'm moving to Las Vegas. You're moving to Las Vegas? What are you going to do? You're with the rabbi your whole life, now you're going to move to Sin City? How does that happen? So you see already, Lot was not such a fine character man. For him to leave Avraham and to go live in a city of perversion and decadence, he moved to a city that they committed the worst of crimes and the worst of sin. I mean, even his wife, so the woman he married, was fighting him when he wanted to invite guests. We don't do that. That's not our way. That's why Hakim says she turned into a pillar of salt, because she wouldn't even offer salt to the guests when they came. So that's how Lot was. You know, a person marries such a person, you see his personality. But one thing is very interesting, Hachamim tell us about Lot. When the angels came to destroy Sedom, they came and they appeared as people. And they knocked on Sedom's door, and they knocked on Lot's door. And Lot brought them in. Even though he knew that he was risking his life. You know, in Sedom, if you invite guests and they catch you, they kill you for that. That's a death penalty. Where did Lot get such a commitment in hospitality? I mean, this is a man that made a statement once and said, "Efshi Avraham belo belohav." He said, "I'm not interested in Abraham, and I'm not interested in Abraham's God." So this was a man that obviously was a rogue himself, and now all of a sudden, when it comes to hospitality, he's willing to die to invite guests, even to risk his life. So Achamim say a very important lesson over here. Because when he was young, he lived with his uncle. And he saw his uncle Avraham, how much inviting guests and hospitality meant to him. And we have a rule that what a child witnesses when he's young, that makes an indelible impression on that child. And those lessons he carries the rest of his life. Maybe on other things, Lot was not so careful. But one thing he saw time and time again, how Abraham Avinu would do anything when it comes to guests. And that stuck with Lot forever and ever. And that's a great lesson that we must learn as we're parenting our children. Because the things that our children are going to witness when they're young, the values that we set in our homes, that is going to carry them for the rest of their lives. You know, you wonder, you see certain people, they're not the best of character, but certain things they're careful on. You say, well, what are you careful on that for? You know, this is something that he's, you know, he'll never miss mincha on Friday. He doesn't come to shul all week, but mincha on Friday, saying shida shirim, he doesn't miss. What are you doing? Oh, my father never missed mincha. This was his thing. He always would come to mincha. So that's how it works. When the child sees a certain importance that the father and mother have in the home, even if the child's not going to be perfect, but those things will stick with them forever. Even if it defies logic. I mean, this defies logic. Lot is risking his life for this mitzvah, even though he's not doing anything else. So you're a hypocrite. What are you doing? For this you're going to die for? You don't care about any of this stuff. So that's how overwhelming impressions are. That when you see something when you're young, it could defy logic. Why when you're old you're still following it? But you'll still follow it. Because that becomes a priority. Chas v'shalom, if children were subject to abuse when they were young. So what happens? If children were subject to abuse, there's two types of children, the way they react. They come along and say, I'll never do this to my children. Well, they saw it, they don't want to do it. But what happens many times is, they do it to their children. And yes, so what are you doing? Defies logic. That's how overwhelming the impressions that you can't even explain it. You said you weren't going to do it. You said you're going to be different. You were victimized by this. But the impressions are so strong that sometimes it's uncontrollable. That's the only way you know. So there we have to be so careful the behavior that we model in our homes, because it's going to come out in the children later on, and we want to make sure that the values that we teach them are proper. There's another lesson on parenting in this week's parasha, which is worthy to say over, from Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. In this parasha, we read how Abraham evicted Hagar and Ishmael out of his home. Not an easy thing for Abraham to do. Abraham is a man of peace. Abraham is a man of acceptance. A diplomat, a man that brings people closer, and here God tells him he has to throw his own wife and his own child out in the street. Not something easy to do. And the pasuk says he sends them out with some bread and water, and they go out in the field, Hagar and Ishmael, and they run out of water, and now Ishmael is dying of thirst. And the pasuk writes that Hagar says, "Al ir'e b'mot hayalid." I cannot see the death of my son. So it says she went harhek kimtacha v'keshet. She distanced herself, and as the situation got worse, she kept on just. She's like, "I can't see this. I cannot see my child. I can't see him die." So she kept on walking far away from the situation. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch says, this is not the trait of what a Jewish mother would do. Does a Jewish mother leave her child to die? Nobody wants to see a child die. Of course it's miserable. Of course it's a painful feeling. But the rabbi says, the duty of a parent, that overrides a person's selfish ego. That it overrides. We understand it was difficult for Hagar to see it. But would a Jewish mother abandon a child at this time? Even if she could give a millions of support or just to be next to the child, to hold his hand at this time. But for a mother to put herself in front of her child, for a mother to worry about her own selfish feelings that she can abandon a child because she can't see him, it's not about you, Hagar. It's not about Hagar. It's about Ishmael. Rabbi Hirsch's words on, I'd like to quote them. He says, the feeling of duty, meaning a parent's obligation, master the strongest emotions, make one forget one's own painful feelings. Now this is a great lesson we may learn in parenting, because Our children did not ask to come into this world. We brought them into this world without giving them a choice, without giving them an option. They came here against their will. And therefore, it's our obligation as parents and our responsibility to raise them. Of course, it might be impossible to provide our children with happiness. It might be beyond us. But it's now our obligation to provide them with the tools in order to attain happiness. Unfortunately, happiness today in our society is defined by pleasure. And therefore, parents think that if they spoil their children with all sorts of pleasures and things and items, that this will give their children happiness. Of course, we see so many cases how this is not true, and I think everybody in this room will agree that this is not exactly how we provide our children happiness. It's clear that it's our obligation to provide our children with a certain spiritual element of life, mainly a Torah education. Even though it might be difficult on a parent to burden the tuition, and the parent might have to give up a vacation or might have to give up a certain luxury or a trip or a car or something in order to educate, but how unfortunate would it be if a parent would put themselves first and say, I'm not willing to give up a certain pleasure at the expense of my children's education, or at the expense of something that will benefit my child, or a therapy that my child needs, or a tutor that my child needs. Unfortunately, the duty of a parent, Rabbi Hirsch is saying, that overrides everything. And therefore the child's need, of course, must come first, because it's your obligation. And even though it might put the parent in an uncomfortable situation, and even though it causes the parent pain, but that's the role of parents. Doesn't say anywhere that the parent's emotion come before the child. On the contrary, the Torah said that was Hagar's mistake. She put herself before Yishmael. She should have stayed there, but it's uncomfortable. It's not about you, Hagar. It's about your child. He comes first. This we see, Rabotai, ladies, when our children start to date. Now, of course, parents need to have input on who their children are eventually going to marry. There's no question about it. This is a monumental decision in their lives. And many times our children are not mature enough to make this decision without input from parents. And therefore, it's necessary for parents to be involved in such a decision. But many times, our children will bring home somebody that's decent, somebody that's befitting. But because the parent has a personal issue, either because they feel that the family is beneath their dignity, we're not talking about low lives. We're talking about because it's a slight to their honor, because they're worried about perception, because they're worried about what people are going to say. So they're putting their honor, their reputation, their dignity before their child. It's not about you. Now, of course, in certain cases, a parent has to say, this is not for us, we don't accept it, this is wrong, there's no question about it. But in some cases, the parent has to really think, why am I breaking this off? Is it because it's going to affect me, because I can't get over a certain personal issue, and therefore I'm punishing my child? That's exactly what Hagar did. Hagar put herself first. Hasba Shalom, we have in our community children that are suffering from all sorts of addictions, whether it's drugs or gambling or other things of such nature. And while there are many parents that come to grips with this addiction, and they have no shame to send their children to rehabilitation and to make sure that their children get the help that they need, but there's just as many parents that deny it. Why? Because they don't want anybody to know. Because they have a reputation. Somebody should walk in the street and say, oh, your son is a drug addict, or your son is a gambler. So therefore they keep it quiet, and they don't give the child the proper help. So you're putting yourself in front of your child. You're putting your honor, you're putting your dignity, you're putting the public perception in front of your kids. This is exactly what Hagar did. Hagar said, it's about me. I cannot cry. It's too emotionally disturbing for me to see this. So she walked away and left her kid as dead. That's not the way of Jewish women, Jewish mothers. The Torah says, based on Rabbi Hirsch, the feeling of duty, master the strongest emotions, make one forget one's own painful feelings. And that's an important lesson to remember as parents, that we must put the child's interest before our interest. Of course we have to guide them and we have to mentor them and teach them right from wrong. But we always have to remember that if it's to their benefit and we're just worrying about our honor, we have to get over that hurdle in order to do their benefit. I'd like to make one more point. Towards the end of the parasha, it says that Avraham Avinu made a party. It's good to end off on a party note. Avraham Avinu made a party for Yitzhak, his son. Yitzhak was born in this week's parasha. It says, Vayas Avraham Mishte Gadol. He made a big party. And this is something to analyze. What is exactly a big party in the Torah's world? How does the Torah define Mishte Gadol? Rashi tells us Mishte Gadol, a big party, means that he invited very important people to the party. You had Hachamim there, Shem, Ever, you had heads of state. It says Abimelech was there. You had important, noble, royal people that came to the party. So I thought to myself, is that the way we would define today in our society, Mishte Gadol? If we come home from a wedding and we say, oh, this was a big wedding, a very Mishte Gadol. What do we mean when we say Mishte Gadol? We mean that there was a lot of centerpieces, that there was a lot of flowers, that there was a lot of couches, that there was a lot of furnishings, that there was a lot of money that was spent, that everybody was dressed in all sorts of exquisite gowns. To us, Mishte Gadol is on the details, on all the materialist things. The Torah is telling us that's not the way God looks at Mishte Gadol. We judge a big party by who's invited, by the people that were there. A party can be made in a very modest hall, in a very simple with very simple food. But if you have great people that are there, in God's eye, this is Mishte Gadol. This is already considered a big party. Doesn't matter if it's catered by an expensive caterer or it's planned by some party planner that's trying to spend money for somebody else. The Torah is telling you, Mishte Gadol, who was there at the party? Hachamim were there, noblemen were there, decent people were there. Then already it's considered a great party. And I want to tell you what Rabbeinu Bachya says. Rabbeinu Bachya says, when did Avraham make this party exactly? Well, he says, some say he made the party on the day he was born. Others say he made the party on the day that he was circumcised. It was the Brit Milah. It was the first Brit Milah, Se'uda. The Pasuk says, B'yom Higgamel et Yitzhak. The Hachamim learned from the word Higgamel. Higgimal, 5 and 3 is 8. Hag is 8, and Mal is circumcision. Mishte Gadol, B'yom Higgamel et Yitzhak. Hag Mal, the 8th day of the Milah. But the Ben Ubachi says, no. The party was done when he was 2 years old. Now she brings the same thing down. But the Ben Ubachya says, why would he make him a party when he's 2 years old? So he says, because that was the day he sent him to the yeshiva. He sent him to go study Torah. So he says, you're going to ask me, he's 2 years old, isn't that a little young? He says, well, Avraham Avinu went to yeshiva when he was 3. It says, at 3 years old already, he understood who God was. So he expects he wants better for his children. Look at the way they looked at Torah education in those days. On the day that they sent their kid to the yeshiva, they invited all the noble people together and they sat there and had a se'udah. How fortunate were they that their son now is going to sit and study the law of God, he's going to read Torah, he's going to learn. Today, unfortunately, it's the exact opposite. On the last day of school, everybody's making parties. Finished the last day of school, we don't have to come back. On the contrary, in the olden days, the first day of school, they made a party. You have zechuta to go study Torah. Ladies, if you have children that are of age to go to the yeshiva, you should not deprive them from this big zechut to send them off for 1 or 2 years or 3 years to study in the yeshiva. Studying in yeshiva is much more prestigious than studying in college. Look what happens on the college campuses throughout this country over here. I can tell you with very, very, very strong certainty that there are no binge drinking on yeshiva campuses. But in college campuses, there's all sorts of indecent behavior. There is no immorality in the yeshiva dormitories. as it's done in the college dormitories throughout this country. And there we should be very proud when our children want to go study for a year or two after high school to study in the yeshiva. In the olden days, they'd send their kids when they're 2 years old, go learn Torah, and they were celebrating. They did it b'simcha. They thanked God that they were so fortunate that God gave them a child that they could devote at least for a few years to study Torah. That's a Jewish mother's attitude and a father's attitude. That when the kid goes to yeshiva, it's not a sad day. One mother came to you and said, my son's going to study in the yeshiva. It's terrible. I don't want him to go. I'm so upset. What could you do for me, Rabbi? I said, go check your mezuzot, maybe. She said, oh, that's a good idea. She looked at it as a tragedy. She looked at it as a catastrophe. But Hazrat Shalom, we don't look at it like that. We look at it as Mishteh Gadol, as it's a party. It's a time of Simchat Torah. It's a celebration of Torah. Baruch Anu Ani Anam.